There are stark photos of the Port of Long Beach in Los Angeles with no shipping containers in it, because all of those shipping containers came from one port, the Port of Guangzhou, or maybe, you know, intermediate through an intermediary like Singapore or Hong Kong. And they are not emitting from those ports anymore, which means that everything from Happy Meal toys to COVID masks, ironically, are all delayed in shipping and may never reach our shores, at least not in good time. And so it plays up the need for considerations beyond shareholder value in the way that we manage our economy, that the short-term individual shareholder value is actually antithetical to both their long-term interests, because, of course, it doesn't matter where your money is today. You're taking a bath because all of the markets are cratering. And also to our society, because the reason that those markets are cratering is that we're facing an existential threat to our civilization.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, author, journalist, and digital rights activist Cory Doctorow visits with John and Scoop in the virtual studio. In this episode, Cory takes us on a deep dive into COVID-19, copyright reform, and adversarial interoperability.
We're the Plutopia News Network. I'm John Lepkoski, and my co-host is Scoop Sweeney. We interview people with compelling, often world-changing ideas. You can find us as Plutopia on Twitter, Plutopia News on Instagram, Plutopia News Network on Facebook and Tumblr. Our guest for this episode is one of the most compelling thinkers with some of the most compelling ideas, Cory Doctorow. He's a science fiction author, activist, and journalist, and a very busy person. He is the author of Radicalized and Walk Away, and other books, novels, short stories, nonfiction. He also has worked for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is an MIT Media Lab research affiliate, a visiting professor of computer science at Open University, a visiting professor of practice at the University of South Carolina's School of Library and Information Science, and he co-founded the UK Open Rights Group. I said he was busy, and it's true. So, Cory, as a science fiction writer who's explored catastrophic futures, what do you think of the emergence and spread of COVID-19 and how it's been handled and the effect it's kind of having?
Well, I think that it's putting a lot of failure modes into stark relief. I think that, you know, it's very easy to tell how a system is working, but it's harder to predict how it's going to fail, and even harder to get people exercised about how it might fail. I mean, people were really excited about the novel hull design of the Titanic and less concerned about the shortage of lifeboats until it was too late. And I think we're seeing some elements of that. You know, from the idea that we can kind of just hand wave away the authoritarian nature of Chinese government and just say, well, they're authoritarian, but they're good at it. That you know, we can trust them to just kind of chug along, because when crisis strikes, they'll just figure it out. They'll just order people to stop having a crisis. And one of the things that we know about authoritarian states is that they're subject to something called authoritarian blindness. Zeynep Tufekci wrote about this very well last week as we're recording this. And authoritarian blindness is when no one wants to tell the authoritarian the bad news that might get them in trouble. And so the authoritarian goes on blithely making orders, believing that they're in possession of good information about the state of things on the ground. And those orders are often disastrous. So in China, the last big authoritarian blindness moment we had was when no one wanted to tell Mao that the crops were failing. And so he said, well, my goodness, we're going to end up with all these strategic food reserves going rotten in the silos. So he issued a communique advising Chinese people to start eating five meals a day. They sold off all the strategic food reserves for hard currency and then had a famine that killed 30 million people. She, it appears, was not able to understand what was going on until things were quite progressed, in part because he has fostered an environment in which the internet has ceased to be the kind of early warning system that it was under previous Chinese administrations, under Deng, for example, where although there was plenty of surveillance and censorship, it was moderated by the authorities understanding that if they spied on everyone's discontented discussions, that they would figure out where the really corrupt and bad local administrators were before they created problems that could reverberate through society. But she was not able to spot that, that things were quite advanced by the time the central apparatus took notice of it.
Well, because they tried to cloak it. They hid it. They didn't let the... I mean, there was a guy who was reporting the problem, and he was tossed in jail, right?
Yeah, they arrested a whistleblower. There's another whistleblower who just came forward to say that she was muzzled as well. She didn't go to jail. She took on board the state orders to silence herself, even though she knew that things were worse than they appeared. And then another way in which this has shown up some of the failure modes of our system is that 40 years of shareholder capitalism has established the idea that any management team that builds redundancy into its logistics is depriving the shareholders of money that could be returned to them in the form of a dividend. And so management teams have become allergic to redundancy. And as a result, we now have these supply chains that have these very brittle links in them. We don't have backups for them. We have hub and spoke airline systems that cannot talk to each other if the hubs go down. The spokes are left abandoned if the hubs go down. We have logistical versions of this. You know, there are stark photos of the Port of Long Beach in Los Angeles with no shipping containers in it because all of those shipping containers came from one port, the Port of Guangzhou, or maybe, you know, intermediate through an intermediary like Singapore or Hong Kong. And they are not emitting from those ports anymore, which means that everything from Happy Meal toys to COVID masks, ironically, are all delayed in shipping. And may never reach our shores, at least not in good time. And so it plays up the need for considerations beyond shareholder value in the way that we manage our economy, that the short-term individual shareholder value is actually antithetical to both their long-term interests, because, of course, it doesn't matter where your money is today. You're taking a bath because all of the markets are cratering. And also to our society, because the reason that those markets are creating is that we're facing an existential threat to our civilization. And, you know, reality has a well-known leftist bias. And here it is once again, unfairly ridiculing the philosophies of Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman. And those poor guys, if only their fantasy world could reassert itself, they would finally get a fair shake from an unbiased reality.
Well, and another problem is that we have leadership that has undermined the authority of science and media and so forth. And you know, we can't really get the word out. People are, I mean, there may be some preppers who are heading for the fort, but what we really have is a lot of people who are saying they don't believe that this problem exists, and they're just going on about their business, even if they've been infected.
Yeah, I think that there's a little more to it than just the idea that they have discredited these agencies, discredited expert agencies in their conclusions, although there's certainly been a lot of that. You know, I'm not the first person to observe that if your political philosophy is that governments do everything badly, then when you govern, you can prove your point by governing badly. And there's a kind of perverse incentive to be terrible at your job to prove your point. But in addition to that, I think that the rise of concentration in markets that has led to a circumstance in which most industries are now dominated by, you know, between two and five firms has also led to a failure in their regulation. For one thing, everyone who's qualified to regulate an industry that's concentrated tends to come from the upper ranks of one of the few giants that dominate the industry. You know, there's a reason that the last FCC chairman under Obama, the one we all like in retrospect, Tom Wheeler, was an ex-Comcast lobbyist, and that the one that we all dislike for killing net neutrality, Trump's FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, is an ex-Verizon lawyer. Apart from Susan Crawford, there are very few people who are not senior officials in the telecoms industry who could conceivably serve as the regulator of that industry. And as a consequence, the quality of regulation has been in free fall, right? To say that you don't trust a regulator's conclusions about the industry that they're supposed to regulate, it's not an entirely irrational position. You know, I happen to believe that vaccines are safe, and think that we should all vaccinate our children. But I don't believe that merely because the FDA says so. After all, this is the same FDA that let the hyper-concentrated pharmaceutical industry murder 200,000 Americans with the opioid epidemic while turning a blind eye to the bad evidence that they used for the safety of their product. And those FDA officials were drawn from the upper ranks of those firms. And so to turn around and say, well, I don't trust anything the FDA says, it's not wrong. It is wrong to say, and that's why I don't believe in vaccines, but it's not wrong to say that the conclusions of our regulators are increasingly tilted towards not evidence-based reality, but rather the parochial desires of an increasingly concentrated industry. You know, ProPublica just did a superb long-form investigative piece on the problems with child car seats. And the National Highway Traffic Safety Board has devolved testing and regulation of those seats to the companies that make them. And so the companies knew that to be competitive, that they had to advertise to parents that their seats were safe for very small children, because parents don't want to lug around those big bulky car seats. They like little booster seats, and that they were safe inside impacts. And so they made claims on their U.S. versions of their products that they did not make anywhere else. You know, they told Americans that smaller children could be safe in their seats than they told Canadians. They told Canadians not to use those seats for small children. And they advertised that the seats had been tested for side impacts. And it's true, they had been, albeit in these very mild tests that the industry does that are very mild relative to the other kinds of impact tests that the DOT actually undertakes. And what they didn't mention when they said side impact tested was that their crash test dummies had dramatically failed those tests, that they had suffered something called internal decapitation. And so they said side impact tested, but not side impact tested and found grossly inadequate. And in the leaked memos that ProPublica published, you see top executives at these companies saying, making these claims is enough because we know that our customers believe that when we make these claims that they have been assessed by objective government agencies. And so everyone whose children were crippled by this, you know, maimed for life by being in a side impact or killed by being in a side impact while in one of these inadequate chairs, all of those people now have good reason not to believe in expert agencies. And not just them, but everyone they're related to, all of their friends, all of their loved ones, all the classmates of their children, and all of their families and friends and loved ones are now, you know, patient zero in a virus of mistrust in our expert agencies.
The World Health Organization just had announced that it is officially a pandemic for COVID-19. And same time that the Trump administration has been systematically eliminating scientists from the CDC. And that goes along with all these other industries you were talking about. How can you trust the advice coming from this agency that's supposed to be the be-all and end-all for dangers to the public? How can we trust them? And what do you think Trump is going to do now that he's been saying this is kind of like the flu, we will get better? You know, how do you recover from this? It is a pandemic now.
Can I add to the fact that that Trump has been dismembering the regulatory systems specifically because he supposedly opposes regulation for some of the reasons that we were just discussing? But in fact, he seems to be, I mean, it's just bizarre the way that it's working. And the CDC is less reliable now because of Trump's influence.
I agree. Although, you know, I want to be really clear here that this is not, this is a bipartisan disease. You know, I think that by and large, we've had better regulators under Democrats than Republicans. But, you know, not where it counts. You know, Obama filled his military national security advisory with Beltway bandits, and he filled his finance directorate with people from rapacious investment banks that had just crashed the economy, and we just had Biden moot that the head of his treasury would likely be the chairman of Goldman Sachs. So, you know, this is hardly unique to Republicans. You know, there is a bilateral American political consensus that rich people should be in charge of what is real. not just what our policy is, but what our truth is. And it is discrediting the entire political process as well. I think, you know, I have a theory of change that I call peak indifference. And so when you have a problem where you have the cause and effect relationship separated by a lot of time and space, you know, like say climate change or smoking and cancer, it can be really hard to know that there's a problem, and even harder to convince other people that there's a problem because the evidence is slow to come. But over time, even if you fail to convince people that there's a problem, if the problem is indeed real, people start convincing themselves. And they start convincing themselves because the policy debt that you accumulate comes due, right? People end up paying the interest in the hardest way. You know, they get lung cancer. Their city catches fire. People they love die of COVID-19. And when that moment strikes, the risk is that we will slide from denial into nihilism, right? That, you know, if the only time I can get you to care about rhino populations is when there's only one left, it's pretty tempting to say, well, we might as well find out what he tastes like. And so I worry that the denial of the Trump administration will give way to nihilism. And I think that there is an element of this that's calculated within the way that they think about this. I think some of them genuinely don't believe it's real. Other ones are like, you know what? If it's real, then at the very least, when it comes due, we'll have a wonderful crisis that we can keep from going to waste, right? We can bring in the migration controls that the courts wouldn't let us bring in. We can bring in all kinds of policies that we would have otherwise struggled to make into reality because the emergency will be the justification for it.
I think this sort of points to something that you wrote about in Globe and Mail recently about it was your thing about science fiction and the unforeseeable future, as to the role of science fiction in like creating a future. You talked about how science fiction isn't great at predicting things, but it could possibly help us imagine better things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's this idea in behavioral economics called the availability heuristic, which says that we over-attribute the likelihood or overweight the likelihood of events that we can vividly picture. You know, it's really easy to vividly picture a terrorist attack, thanks in part to the way that our media treats those attacks, which are extremely rare and not a particularly important source of mortality. And so we tend to worry a lot about it, as opposed to things that actually kill a lot of people, like flu. You know, we just had the president say that not only does he not know that the flu kills people, nobody knows that the flu kills people. He's sort of right about that, although his grandfather died of the flu, so it's weird. But, you know, we really underweight those concerns. And so when we read fiction in which disaster is followed by bestiality, right? The in which the moment of crisis precipitates a kind of unleashing of the inner animal, the red of tooth and claw nature of the human animal, and your neighbors come over to eat you. Then we make it really easy to believe that when disaster strikes, that's what's going to come. And then even if you don't believe it, right? Even if you're like, actually, most people are okay. And, you know, if there was a disaster, they would share with me just as I would share with them. When the crisis strikes, I'm not going over to my neighbor's house with a shotgun. I'm bringing them a covered dish. If you think that your neighbor is going to greet you with a shotgun, then it's harder for you to come over with the covered dish. And so, you know, for example, I believe that most people are pretty good. And if we run out of toilet paper here in Burbank, California, that my neighbor will probably let me bum a roll. Ha ha. And at the same time, our stores are all out of toilet paper. And so if we want to be sure that we'll have toilet paper, we have to engage in hoarding behavior, right? If we find some toilet paper in a store, we have to buy it all. And so this collective action problem, not of humanity's true bestial nature, but in the false belief of humanity's bestial nature, the thing that we get from Pulp Fiction, it drives the outcomes that it predicts, that it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I'm interested in what happens when we have stories that more closely reflect the actual lived experience of people in crises. There's a brilliant book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell that very closely tracks what happens during real crises, especially those that we remember as times in which people behave very badly. And Solnit, she's an historian. She's the person who coined the term mansplaining. And she goes back to these primary source documents, you know, journal entries, letters home, newspaper articles from disasters, starting with the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and all the way up to Katrina and the Haiti quake. And what she shows is that it really is the moment, that disaster really is the moment where that background refrigerator hum of petty grievance stops and leaves behind this ringing silence where you realize that your neighbors are your allies, that you have more in common with them than ever held you apart, and that you owe to them and they owe to you a duty of care. It's the moment in which people pull together. And so if we tell those stories, then it'll be easier to believe that your neighbors believe that you are kind, and therefore you can afford to be kind to them. And that is, I think, the duty that storytellers have, is to not only tell the truth about human nature, but to lay the groundwork for graceful failure, to put the lifeboats on the Titanic before we launch it, so that when things go wrong, because everything goes wrong in a complex system, you know, the way that you build robust complex systems is not by assuming that they'll never break down, it's by planning for a graceful failure, and to put the lifeboats on our civilizational Titanic so that when things go wrong, they'll be there to rescue us all.
Yeah, I really hope that those stories are going to be told. But right now, the cable news and the administration are telling the story that those white knights in shining armor from the pharmaceutical companies are going to come to the rescue, and they're going to do it any day now. And I think we all know that what's probably happening right now is the execs are all out ordering new Lamborghinis for all their family.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's another way in which the crisis is revealing the bankruptcy of ideology. You know, I worked on the Access to Medicines Treaty at WIPO with the group that's now called Knowledge Ecology International, Jamie Love's outfit. And the Access to Medicines Treaty was opposed by pharmaceutical companies that said that if only we would allow them unlimited exclusive rights to their discoveries, including those that were heavily subsidized by the public sector through public universities and so on, that they would produce all the drugs that we needed to be safe. And instead, what they do with the excess rents that they get from those monopolies is repackage heart disease medicine as boner pills. And they do very, very little of the work that we need them to do to keep us safe.
Your recent column on copyright really moved me. In which you stated that a lever without a fulcrum is just a stick, and that relates very much to what's going on with not just the pharmaceutical companies, but all companies, the big music industry, movies, all the copyright things that are going on are ridiculous. And tell us, what got you into championing a change in copyright?
I came at it through a kind of general mistrust of corporations in the 80s, where we saw, you know, an increasingly heavy-handed approach as the industry started to consolidate. And it kind of culminated with the Negative Land thing. This is a deep cut, but, you know, Negative Land was this, like, weird alt-rock cut-up band that was a cult favorite. I love their music. And they took U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, and made a single called The Letter U, the Numeral 2, that very sarcastically made fun of the song while looping a sample of it. And it was, I think, the first major sampling lawsuit. And they got their asses handed to them, and they had their music destroyed, right? The U2 and their label ordered their music destroyed. There was a hilarious kind of early cyber culture element to this, which is that Mondo 2000 was approached to interview U2 because Mondo 2000 was this, at the time, this like super hip, bleeding edge cyber culture zine, and U2 kind of fancy themselves heroes of the internet revolution. And so their publicist pitched Mondo on interviewing them. And so Negative Land was given the interview. So they interviewed them for Mondo and didn't reveal that they were the guys from Negative Land until three quarters of the way through the interview. So they asked them a bunch of questions about it and they say, oh yeah, by the way, we made that single. So anyway, I started there and along came the P2P revolution maybe a decade later with Napster. And I saw how Napster took the world of music in which 80% of the music that had ever been recorded was not available for sale at any price in the stream of commerce as new product and made it all available almost overnight, you know, the fastest adopted technology in the history of the world. And I witnessed Napster go to the record labels and say, just tell us how many zeros you want at the end of the check. We want to pay the artists for this music, just the way the way radio stations do and live performance venues do. We don't want to negotiate with everyone. We just want to pay them, you know, in the same way that all the other blanket music licenses work. And instead, the labels sued them out of existence. And in their bid to fight against the new forms of file sharing, the peer-to-peer file sharing built on Nutella and other exotic protocols, the labels demanded increasing degrees of control and censorship over the internet. They sued tens of thousands of children. They actually at one point constitute a significant fraction of all the private lawsuits in federal courts where record labels suing school children. They used the leverage that they had over young people who they knew universally were engaged in copyright infringement to insist on just bestial, disgusting things. So they went after a kid who maintained an open source search tool called Flatland that was widely used for lots of different things, including sharing music, but also, you know, on campuses for, you know, profs who wanted to share their, you know, PowerPoint slides or MP3s of their lectures. And when they went after this kid, they said, look, you know, the statutory damages in the for the music we know you downloaded exceed like the GDP of the planet. So we're going to settle with you as we do with everyone we sue this way. And we're going to ask you, as we do with everyone else, to give us your life savings. But as a special condition for you, we want you to change majors. We don't want you to be a computer science major anymore, because we think that people who write software or maintain software the way you do have no business being in this industry. And so you had this thing where, and I should add, EFF came to this guy's rescue, the record labels backed off, but this is the kind of leverage they had over people. And when everyone is presumptively guilty of something, then you open up the door for this kind of selective enforcement. And sure enough, you know, when Russia entered the WTO, the U.S. government insisted that they sign on to the TRIPS, which is the copyright and patent element of the WTO agreement. And then as soon as Russia did adopt those rules, they began shutting down independent newspapers under the guise of policing Microsoft's operating system copyrights. They would go in, confiscate all of their computers, say, we don't believe that your license keys are genuine, and just shut down the newspapers and, you know, incidentally also find out who all their sources were and so on. So it became this, you know, existential threat to the internet and to our democracy. And it was being done in my name. You know, I'm a full-time professional artist. I'm a New York Times bestseller who's written 20-some books. And this was all being done in the name of defending me. And it wasn't enriching me. It was just creating this situation in which you had increased concentration in the entertainment sector and in the online sector. Because as it became more and more expensive to operate an online service because of all the copyright compliance, the number of companies entering the market dwindled to effectively zero, right? We now have like just YouTube and to a lesser extent Facebook Video, and then everyone else is an also-ran. And so you had the online sector, which was able to squeeze artists harder. And then you also had the same thing happening in the entertainment sector. Because it was harder and harder to get your stuff online without them, they were able to corral more and more artists into contracts that were increasingly abusive. And so you had this, you know, long battle in which the labels or the entertainment corporations and the technology corporations fought back and forth over shifting a few points from one balance sheet to the other while making more and more and more and more money off of entertainment while artists' revenues were dropping. And every time we gave artists more copyright, it just meant that whoever was in control of the distribution system, a tech company or an entertainment company, would just say that as a condition of using their platform, you had to sign away the new right that Congress had just given you. And so they ended up with more and more control, ironically, the using the tools that were supposed to give artists the ability to exercise leverage over them.
In my own work, I've experienced the strangeness of the copyright gods. I do internet radio. I have since it became a thing in the early 2000s, and found out that they had created radio ghettos, if you will, that the rules for commercial over-the-air radio were that you could pretty much play anything, anytime. But when the internet radio began gathering an audience and having an influence, they decide, well, no, you can't do what the commercial guys do. You know, a commercial broadcaster can play a whole album if he wants to. But internet radio, you can only play three songs from that album in a three-hour period. And that's just the kind of things they've done to the copyright laws just over the last 10 or 15 years. So it's a very strange environment out there. And the minute someone gets a toehold in whatever their art is, someone's going to find a way to legislate it out of existence.
Yeah, I mean, the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel that set the royalties and rules for this stuff, they started off with a pretty lax set of rules that reflected the kinds of rules we had for radio and live performance and other similar blanket licenses. But that was an interim regime. And when they finalized the rules, they set these onerous requirements, not just about what you could play, but also the royalty rates themselves. And I had an off-the-record, very candid conversation with a record executive who said, we hate blanket licenses. We hate the idea that there will be thousands of people operating their own little radio stations out there and that we won't be able to control them. We want rules that will make most of those independent radio stations extinct and to have them kind of consolidate into a few large firms, which is what we see today, because then we can all gather around a table and we can agree on bespoke deals that are separate from the ones that are being mandated through these royalty panels. And that's exactly what they got. That kind of impedance matching between large monopolistic firms who want other large monopolistic firms in their supply chain so that they can all gather around a table, it's a recurring motif. You know, I think a lot of people looked at that photo of all the leaders of tech sitting around a table with Donald Trump at Trump Tower after the inauguration and were really upset that they were meeting with this guy whose values were so poor. And I was upset about that, too. But I was just upset about the fact that all the leaders of tech fit around a single boardroom table. I mean, if that doesn't alarm you, it doesn't matter who they're meeting with. If that doesn't alarm you, then you're not paying attention.
The whole thing of compensation for artists, as it's been horrible since practically day one. All the, you know, the evil contracts entered into by early blues, African American blues and R&B artists. You know, they sell their song for $50, and the record company makes millions. And it hasn't gotten any better. You know, it doesn't matter how successful these people are, they still are at the mercy of, you know, those contracts. And I was part of a band that, you know, got a nice contract with a major label, and everybody was looking around to, you know, go order their Porsche and get their trophy wife. And I had to tell them, no, read this thing. And it's basically 9 or 10 items that they're going to keep for themselves, and we're going to give you this little thing over here.
Sure. I mean, that's a recurring motif, I think, with any new rights for artists. You know, when the when the early days of hip hop were around, most sampling was undertaken without any kind of license or thought of a license. You know, Dizzy Gillespie had been accustomed to pulling five or six bars out of a popular song and sticking it in a solo. And in the same way, grabbing a couple of bars of a R&B song and sticking it in a loop was not considered to be a copyright infringement. And if there was a copyright issue, I think most samplers believed that it was de minimis. It was below the threshold for legal notice. And so we created this system over time with lawsuits and with industry practice where now all samples are cleared. And that drove an entire genre of music extinct, right? One of the reasons that hip-hop today sounds very different from the early top-grossing albums like Paul's Boutique and It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back is because if those albums, which were the most profitable albums at the time, had had to clear their samples, they would have lost millions of dollars. And so it simply became financially impossible to make that kind of music. And at the same time, although this represented a minor windfall for R&B artists who'd signed those kinds of contracts you're talking about, because the contracts didn't include those sampling royalties, so the labels weren't able to take that money, they had to remit it to the artists. At the same time, the labels just changed their standard deal, and they started to insist that artists sign away their sampling revenue to the labels. And so the labels get all that revenue in the future. And because the people who are making music today are also making samples, the labels get the money from the samples too. So they get them coming and going. And it points to, you know, a way out of all of this. There are ways in which copyright can benefit artists, but they're few and far between, and we don't tend to double down on those. The ones we expand are the ones that benefit corporations because they're the ones with all the lobbyists. So, for example, blanket licenses tend to benefit artists, especially when they specify that the artist must be the beneficiary. So one of the good things about those online licenses, they're administered by SoundExchange, and some of that money goes directly to artists irrespective of their record label deal. And so you could imagine something similar like that, but for all kinds of musical distribution. You know, right now, one of the things that stops people from competing with Spotify or YouTube Music is that you have to go and replicate all of their licensing deals. But if you had a blanket license for that kind of service, and if that blanket license just scaled with the number of users you had, then Facebook would have to buy 2.5 billion licenses for its users. And if you started a new service that only had one user, you would only have to pay for one license. And so you would expend 1 2.5 billionth of what Facebook was expending, but you would have the same catalog and you could compete on a level playing field. You know, a way to think about what blanket licenses do is to imagine the contrafactual for radio or for live performance. Imagine if only one club had the exclusive license to play top 40 music. And so every other club could not play that music. Very quickly, that club would become the only club that anyone went to. They would become a chain. They would dominate the music industry, the live performance industry. And anyone who wanted to have their music do well would have to kowtow to that club in order to get play, right? They would have the catbird seat. They would have the whip hand over artists. So blanket licenses, especially those that specify that artists are entitled to a share of the income irrespective of their contracts, those licenses actually prevent that kind of gatekeeper function from emerging in the market. And they also ensure that artists get paid when their work is generating income. You could also imagine things like reversion clause. So we have reversion in some contracts now. Rights holders, or rather creators, are allowed to insist that their work be reverted to them after 35 years, irrespective of their contractual arrangements. So, for example, George Clinton just got Atomic Dog back from his label, which had ripped him off for years and years and years. And so we could have those reversion contracts be shorter. You know, if they were 10 and 15 year contracts instead of 35 year clauses, then artists would have much more leverage because it's much more likely that work will be performing and generating income after 10 years than after 35 years. The number of works that still perform after 35 years are effectively a rounding error. But if you want to capture revenue for a living artist, give them reversion at 10. And then if the label's not doing well by them, or the publisher or the studio, then they can claim their rights back. And especially in an era of digital distribution platforms, they could do what musicians did when they started to revert their music, which is just upload it to all the platforms, iTunes and Spotify and so on, and keep 100% of the money because it sits there in the same record store that everyone else gets their music from. And then finally, I think if we want to protect artists, we need to do things that aren't copyright related. Like, we need to ban binding arbitration in contracts so that artists can sue when their labels rip them off. And we need to break up super concentrated industries so that it's harder for them to converge on a set of terms so that you you can't shop around for a better deal. And finally, we need to restore unionization. It has historically been artist unions that have gotten the best deals for artists. And those unions have been ground apart by 40 years of Reaganomics. And just like with every other labor sector, one of the ways that we can restore balance and negotiating leverage is by allowing for collective bargaining.
Maybe popular artists who, by virtue of their popularity, have a lot of power, that people like Billie Eilish and Taylor Swift should form a cartel to support artists' rights.
Well, you know, Taylor Swift just did this a little. She was renewing a deal with Universal, and no, maybe it was with Fox. Gosh, I've just blanked. But one of the labels had was not promising to remit its share of the sell-off of a big digital music platform to the artist. They were just going to charge it to their royalty accounts and not guarantee them a share of the income. And Taylor Swift said that as a condition of signing her deal, they had to promise that all of the artists who were situated similar to her that were within that label would get cash payouts and not just a credit to the money that they notionally owed the label. And so you do see that a little bit. You see that kind of solidarity, and it shows you what solidarity gets you, right? Imagine if that were a matter of routine, where instead of waiting for the one-offs of Taylor Swift negotiating that contract, instead you had collective bargaining where the plurality of members and their priorities were represented with a bargaining unit.
One thing that we haven't discussed that I meant to bring up was adversarial interoperability.
Mm-hmm.
Having read your recent piece about that, and I was especially, and maybe you'll say a little bit about this, I was taken with another piece I read where you used Gopher as a an example of adversarial interoperability. So we just have a little time left, and I thought maybe you would talk about that Gopher example.
Yeah. So adversarial interoperability, that's when you have a new product and you make it work with an existing product without permission from the people who made that existing product. You know, think about third-party printer ink, right? They don't ask HP for permission. In fact, they know HP doesn't want them to do it. They still figure out how to make ink that works in your printer. And adversarial interoperability, it's deep in the history of every successful tech company. When you look at something like Apple, well, they were, you know, languishing as a result of Microsoft's lack of a decent Mac Office suite. And so they reverse engineered that suite. They made a compatible suite called iWork, and that made the Mac work inside of enterprises. Or if you think about the IBM PC, you know, they had this proprietary ROM, and a guy named Tom Jennings, the creator of FidoNet, he went and reverse engineered that ROM for a company called Phoenix. And Phoenix made compatible ROMs that got Gateway and Compaq and Dell and put them all in business so that they could make PC compatible software and PC compatible operating systems. And so, you know, a good example of this from the internet age is Gopher. Before there was the web, there was Gopher, and Gopher was a menu-driven way to access all kinds of different services on the internet. They called it internet duct tape, because what they would do is take these services that you normally access by telnetting into them. So what they did was they took all these services that you normally accessed by telnetting into them, and then using these weird syntaxes, like, you know, there was a weather service at the University of Michigan called Weather Underground, or there were FTP servers. They all had their own special commands that you had to remember, and you had to remember their addresses too. And instead, they just made this menu-driven front end, and what these systems did was they, when you went to the menu and said, tell me what the weather is like in Austin, they would autopilot an automated telnet session that was running on the server, on the Gopher server, that would log into the Weather Underground, execute the command, get its output, and turn it into something that was very easy for you to read. So you had a single unified way to access all the university library catalogs, all the FTP servers, every specialized silo. And this was done without permission. And it was done sometimes when the companies didn't want them to do it. Like, for example, they took all of Apple's technical documentation, which was only available on CD-ROM at the time, and they ripped the CDs, and they used these Next servers that the Next were these weird Unix boxes that Steve Jobs made after he left Apple, but before he came back to them. And they ran a thing that eventually became OS X. And they used these Next servers to index them so you could have full text search of all Apple documentation. And then that turned out to be so successful that they started ingesting just massive blocks of text to index them for full text search. So they were like the one of the two competing ways to read Usenet with search. It used to be that you couldn't read message boards with search. You just had to go to the topic for your message board and download all the messages sent by everyone on the internet, because there's really only one messaging system at that point, Usenet. So every internet user on the planet was in, you know, your group for pets or whatever, and you would download everything they'd posted and then search through that for your search terms. And the Gopher guys, they made their own. They did this because they were the people who supported the students at the University of Minnesota. And just making a front end that let all this other stuff work was easier than teaching the students to use each and every one of these services. And it was hugely successful for them. But in the end, there was a physicist, a British physicist, working at CERN in Geneva, who was experimenting with ways to share scientific documents. His name was Tim Berners-Lee, and his experimental tool was called the World Wide Web. And the people who made the first web clients said, you know, with these browsers, we can just absorb all of Gopher. And in addition to http://, we'll have gopher:// since there's almost nothing on the web. And since the Gopher teams all around the world, because by this point there were lots of people running Gopher servers, finding new ways to integrate stuff into Gopher, since there are all these different Gopher servers around the world, we will just make Gopher part of the web, which will give web users a reason to use the web. So they turned around and used adversarial interoperability on Gopher. And today, when you see these big established services like Facebook or Google, you hear a lot about how they have natural monopolies because of network effects. But you know, Gopher had network effects. They had the only network of users. And those network effects became a thing that could be used against them. It was a kind of judo for network effects through adversarial interoperability. Instead of Gopher being the walled garden that contained all of the potential internet users behind a barrier that the web couldn't get at, Gopher became like a kind of pen in which all of the potential internet users had been neatly corralled, and the web could just go in and allow all of those Gopher users to use a better service. And so when you look at companies like Facebook and Google and the other big walled gardens, Apple and so on, what you see are companies that claim that they are big and monopolistic because of a kind of mystical force of nature called network effects. But when you look at what they actually have, they just have monopolistic tactics. You know, these are companies like Google. Google is a company that's made 1.5 successful products. They made a really good search engine and a pretty good Hotmail clone. And everything else is just a company that they bought. And that's something that we used to prohibit under antitrust law, right? Buying nascent competitors, merging with major competitors, creating vertical monopolies. And what you see is that they maintain their monopolies by walling away the very adversarial interoperability that they used when they started off. You know, they have climbed the ladder and kicked it away from them. Facebook started off by scraping the web and putting websites as preview boxes in Facebook pages. Now people who scrape Facebook face criminal and civil liability under a court decision that Facebook secured for itself called Power Ventures. And you know, they're fine with doing this to other people, but now that they've attained dominance, they're not going to let anyone do it back to them.
Learn more about Cory Doctorow at craphound.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.